Reclaiming Boston and the Marathon, today, Monday, April 21st. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A mix of defiance and jubilation here in Boston as thousands run the city's marathon once again. Our reporter says security was tight, but at least one man in the crowd told him that's all right.
He said, you know, it feels pretty good. My wife is in the race today, and I really like to see this kind of security after what happened last year. He said, I bet this is the safest marathon that's ever been run.
Also, the Sherpa guides on Mount Everest contemplate going on strike as Nepal mourns the 13 Sherpas who died after an avalanche on the mountain. And in the concrete jungle that is Beijing, graffiti seems to spruce the place up a bit.
When these guys paint on walls that aren't designated by the government, the citizens think they're making the city look prettier, and indeed they are.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The crowd cheering on the runners in today's Boston Marathon. As you can imagine, for people who live in Boston, that's a great sound to hear after what's been a very emotional year for the city. Today, the focus was back on the race itself. Eritrean-American Meb Keflezighi became the first American man to win in Boston since 1983, and he did so while wearing a bib inscribed with the names of those who died near the finish line a year ago. The World's Matthew Bell was in downtown Boston as the runners came in. He says despite tight security, a lot of people turned out to watch the race.
It was a huge turnout, Marco, and thankfully the weather demons of New England took the day off, and it was just a beautiful day from early this morning. Crowds starting to come out and getting their places along Boylston Street, where the runners come in through a chute and make their way to the finish line. The mood generally was really celebratory. People were in a great mood.
Yeah, so turnout pretty good in part because of this glorious weather we got today. How packed did it look out there on the course?
I made my way down Boylston Street to the finish line about an hour or so before the first runners were going to cross the line. And even then, it was sort of shoulder to shoulder, and it was hard to even get up toward that grandstand area where all the sort of VIPs sit and where people cross the finish line itself. The whole way was lined with people. There are a lot more runners this year, too, than usual. There were 36,000 participants. I guess that was about 9,000 more than usual. There were some changes, too, because they told what they call bandits, people that didn't have an official number, not to join in the race. So it had a little bit of a different feel.
You talked about the celebratory mood among the crowd, among the spectators. If you had to kind of parse that celebratory mood out, more one of jubilance or of defiance?
I mean, I guess it was a little bit of both. You know, as I chatted with people, I talked to one gentleman actually from Beijing, and he also has an apartment here and has lived here for several years in Boston. He was out there to cheer on his daughter, who was running her second marathon, and he told me a story about how last year, when the bombs went off, his daughter had just run past him toward the finish line. He was on his way back to his apartment. He heard the bombs, and then he was amazed to see crowds of people all running toward the explosions. He was worried because his daughter had just passed him. The phones weren't working. So he made his way back to the scene. He reconnected with his daughter and said, you know, it was a really scary moment, but then things turned out to be okay. He told me that it's really important to be out here. It's really important for us to be showing our support. It seemed like every other person, you know, Marco, had a Boston Strong hat or shirt and was just really getting into it and cheering every single participant as they came down Boylston Street.
We've been hearing a lot about security for today. When you're actually on the ground next to the marathon course, what did that security look like?
I've never seen security like this in the streets of Boston. The only thing remotely comparable is when the Democratic Party convention was held here in 2004. And that kind of security, you know, was in the venue, in the Boston Garden. This was very serious security out on the streets. It wasn't so oppressive that people couldn't sort of have fun and move around, but unmistakably, you could see lots of police officers on foot, on bikes, on vehicles. There were clearly plain clothes people out and about. You could see SWAT team members. security just seemed to be at the highest level you could kind of imagine it for a public event like this.
Now, I was hearing on the radio this morning all the warnings, don't bring personal belongings, only in clear plastic bags, no backpacks, no coolers. I mean, you're down there as a reporter. You've got gear. How did you handle it?
Yeah, they were pretty serious about that. They were serious about the flow and where people could and could not go. And Marco, I made the mistake this morning of stepping out of the hotel where they have the press center. It was soon after 6 o'clock. I mean, there weren't many people really gathering down there, but I kind of walked toward the finish line and was immediately stopped because I had my backpack on with my recording gear in it. And a police officer said, hey, you should know better. You know, no backpacks at all on the street today. So I got rid of that and then just walked around with my iPhone and my tape recorder in my hand and traveled light. And so did everybody else.
Was there any talk, Matthew, at all this weekend or today, or even chatter of the Tsarnaev brothers, the alleged perpetrators of last year's bombings?
I think, Marco, the anniversary, of course, there have been stories in the news media and that people have kind of become familiar again with that case that the younger brother is facing now to sort of check in and see what's happening with that. But in general, absolutely not. You know, you down at the race and I just didn't hear any talk about that at all. And people just seem to be, like I said, in a fantastic mood and just really determined to have a good time and to have this thing go off well.
There was Matthew Bell in downtown Boston near the finish line of the Boston Marathon today. Thank you, Matthew.
You're welcome, Marco.
Talk to anyone living in and around Boston, and it's likely they'll have some connection to last year's marathon bombings. Maybe they were running or knew someone who was injured. Maybe they lived near the alleged bombers, Tamerlan and Johar Tsarnaev. Or maybe they just experienced the lockdown in the days that followed. The world's Andrea Crossan has her own connection, and it led her to discover the sport of mixed martial arts.
Last year, on April 19th, I woke up to this.
There is a massive manhunt underway.
That's Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick speaking at a press conference. Overnight, there'd been a shooting, a carjacking, a chase, a gun battle with police. The Tsarnaevs were identified as suspects in the marathon bombings. Tamerlan was dead, and police were looking for his brother.
We're asking people to shelter in place, in other words, to stay indoors with their doors locked and not to open the door for anyone other than a properly identified law enforcement officer.
And so I sheltered in place. During the course of that day, images of the Tsarnaevs were everywhere on TV. Many of the photos were of Tamerlan sparring at a mixed martial arts gym called Y-Crew. I knew the Y-Crew gym. I live above it. It made me wonder how many times I may have walked my dog past Tamerlan going into train. Before that day, I'd never had any interest in that gym below my apartment. But now I wanted to know what drew Tsarnaev to Y-Crew and to mixed martial arts. What I discovered was that for young men like Tamerlan, MMA fighting was an obvious outlet. The sport is huge in the Caucasus region, and for those who are good at it, it can be a ticket to the American dream. That's how I discovered Khabib.
My name is Khabib Nurmagomedov. My nickname is Eagle. Eagle.
Khabib the Eagle Nurmagomedov is a mixed martial arts fighter. Like the Tsarnaevs, he has roots in the North Caucasus. He's Muslim and from the same native ethnic group called Avar. But that's where the similarities end. Nurmagomedov is a success story. He trains at the American Kickboxing Academy in San Jose, California. Javier Mendez is his coach.
He's very dedicated, very hard worker, extremely focused, and extremely talented.
Nurmagomedov is in the lightweight division for the Ultimate Fighting Championship, the UFC. He currently has one of the longest undefeated streaks with 22 straight wins and zero losses. Nurmagomedov is well known here and in his home of Dagestan. He says that he chose the nickname the Eagle because it's the symbol of his home. It's also why he wears a huge lambskin hat before his bouts.
Это папаха называется. Это головной убор моего народа. Все старейшины одевают ее.
It's a papacha. It's a symbol of my people. All the elders wear it. Not just my people, but all the people of the Caucasus. I know that the UFC is more than just a sport. It's a business. You need to have a show. For Americans, the hat is exotic. Many people think it's a wig, but it's not a wig. I just tell them it's the symbol of my people.
There are about 9 million people in the North Caucasus, and they breed fighters. Nurmagomedov has been fighting since he was a child. There's this video on YouTube set to music of an 8-year-old Khabib wrestling with a bear cub. The adults stand around and watch as the 8-year-old grapples with a bear bigger than he is. Nurmagomedov laughs off the bear wrestling, but he's dead serious about his career. He keeps up a grueling training regime. Mixed martial arts combines Thai boxing, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and the Russian martial art of sambo. Like most MMA fighters from Russia and the Caucasus, Nurmagomedov's strongest discipline is sambo. Sambo was created by the Soviet Red Army to improve their hand-to-hand combat abilities. Nurmagomedov says that eventually he wants to open an MMA gym back in Dagestan. He travels back and forth regularly.
A
lot of people, when I say I'm from Russia, Dagestan, they say you're from Pakistan, Kazakhstan. I'm always explaining that Dagestan is a republic of Russia, that it's in the south of Russia, near the Caspian Sea. But people have no idea.
Не знают и никогда не видели Республику Дагестан.
Fight fans might not know that the Eagle is from Dagestan or where Dagestan is. He's just that fighter who wears that crazy white wig. For young men like Nurmagomedov, the mixed martial arts gym is their home away from home. It's a community where they fit in. They can meet people who speak their language and understand their culture. I don't know why Tamerlan Tsarnaev liked going to the Y-Crew gym. I don't know if he imagined having the success that Nurmagomedov has achieved. And I still don't know that much about mixed martial arts, but I follow Khabib the Eagle. And on April 19th, he fought a Brazilian fighter, Rafael dos Anjos.
He's adjusting his hips. He's trying to go for an arm. Oh, boom, right in the kisser. Paid the price.
Khabib won. It was a unanimous decision. For the world, I'm Andrea Crossan.
Big shot.
To the top.
Andrea wasn't kidding about this guy wrestling a bear cub as a kid. You got to see it to believe it, though. Check out the video at PRI.org. Okay, so this past Saturday, I joined the BBC World Service sports program, Sports World, for a special Boston Marathon preview broadcast down by the finish line. And I want to share with you something I learned. As you may know, the Boston Marathon takes place every year on Patriots Day. That's a holiday we have here in Massachusetts. And traditionally, the Red Sox always have a home game that day, too, at Fenway Park, not far from the marathon finish line. They did today. And they did last year, on April 15th, the day of the bombings. The principal owner of the Red Sox, American investor John Henry, is well aware of the impact the marathon bombings had on the city and on his baseball team. Now, here's the part I learned over the weekend. John Henry owns another sports team that's tied to a tragedy that, ironically, also occurred on April 15th. That'd be Liverpool FC, a top soccer team in England. On April 15th, 1989, 25 years ago, Liverpool was playing Nottingham Forest at Hillsborough Stadium in Sheffield, England. There was a stampede inside the stadium as police funneled Liverpool fans into a single overcrowded standing-only section. 96 Liverpool fans died. John Henry didn't acquire the Liverpool team until 2010, but now April 15th is a day that has a somber double meaning for him.
Both clubs in both cities have the same date now. These two cities are linked by these two tragedies.
In the case of Hillsborough, it took more than two decades for officials to admit that police failed to control the crowd that day and then covered up their failure by blaming the Liverpool fans for their own deaths. It wasn't until 2012 that the fans were exonerated. The tragedy remains under investigation, and the 96 dead, as well as the long, slow road to justice for the victims' families, are always on the minds of John Henry and his team.
We wear the 96 on the uniforms. We're aware and have been, the club has been aware of the importance of what these families went through for a quarter of a century, the horror of it, to lose the loved ones, and then the injustice that followed it was something that the club recognizes and feels.
Liverpool FC and Boston Red Sox owner John Henry. You're listening to The World from PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When Carmen Bugan fled communist Romania with her family back in the 1980s, she never thought she'd return. It was still the Cold War, and her father was an outspoken dissident. But this past October, she did return, and she recorded the experience for the BBC. Here's her story.
My family and I left 25 years ago, when our country was still in the grip of the communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. My father, Ion Bugan, staged a one-man protest against Ceausescu at a time when few dared to speak out. His decision changed our lives forever.
So, Carmen, Nicolae Ceausescu was a ruthless dictator. Describe that day when your father staged that protest and what he did and what happened to him.
My father left on 10 March 1983 without telling anyone to Bucharest to stand up against Ceausescu. And he placed the two placards on top of our red Dacia, asking for the trial of the Ceausescu and his family for crimes against humanity and usury and economic downfall. And he was arrested immediately.
He was already a dissident, but had he ever staged any protest as overt as this?
From 1981 until 1983, he and my mother typed anti-communist leaflets at an illegally owned typewriter, and they spread them secretly all over the country.
Wow.
So they were very courageous, the two of them. They had to bury the typewriter in a backyard.
Yeah, explain that, because, I mean, typewriters were obviously instruments of contraband if they were in the wrong hands, right?
Yeah, so, you know, I've written the book Burying the Typewriter, which is focused on me finding my father one day as I was returning from school, burying the typewriter in a backyard. And I asked him why he was burying it. I was very shocked to see him burying our typewriter, because I used it to write little poems and attempt to play. And he didn't say why, but he said, you know, they have to be registered, so they keep coming to check it, so I don't want them to see it anymore. And then I went inside the house, and the typewriter was sitting on a table. And that's when I realized that there were two, and one was illegally owned.
Now, your father ended up by going to jail, but the guilt that was laid on your father then falls on you and your family by association. What was going on in your life while your father was serving time?
The day my father demonstrated, the secret police came into the house and interrogated me about him and what he did.
And you were 12, right?
Yes, I was 12 years old. They didn't tell me what he did, but they tried to get me to tell them what I knew.
What was that like for you? I mean, you're 12 years old. You don't want to implicate your father. You also are driven to tell the truth because you're a kid, right?
Yes, I mean, that was a very difficult moment because he and I had a fight before he left. I knew what he was going to do because I saw him tying the placards on a car. And I said, I know what you're doing, but I'm going to put nails in a car tires so they blow up and then you won't go.
Mm.
He yelled at me that day. He said, you go away and mind your own school and leave me alone. And then when he left in the middle of the night, he said, if anybody comes, you tell them nothing. And then my mom was in a hospital with my brother, who was a month old, and he was very ill. And he really did not tell her anything at all. It was a way to protect her. She went straight under interrogations, which were 24 hours a day.
A whole lot of intel gathering going on, some serious paranoia. And you also had in your home, while your father's in prison, secret police microphones bugging all of you. Have you gone back to read what was transcribed from what was going on in your own apartment?
Yes, there are about 4,500 pages, and I spent the last 3 years researching them and reading them. And so we have everything from our dreams that we recounted to each other in the morning, from the food that we ate, every phone conversation, from the fights we had. And the secret police got to know us so well. They took part in the fights. You will see on the side of their papers, parentheses saying, actually, Carmen is right in this fight.
This is a big part of the documentary you actually made for the BBC. I'd like to listen to another short excerpt from that.
We were just ordinary people. You won't find our names in the story of the Cold War. But there is a hidden chronicle of our lives. My apartment is piled high with our hidden history. Papers, photographs, transcripts of secret recordings. They are fragments from the thousands of files kept on us by Ceausescu's secret police.
Carmen, what was it like going back and reading things that you once presumably said quite often in a very careful choice of words, plus your dreams as well?
You know, I've written a book based on my memory. Bearing the Typewriter is based on a child's memory. Reading the files has been vindicating those memories that I wrote about. I'm able now to say, look, what I was telling you was completely truth and I remember it. Mm. There is also stuff that we didn't remember. There is also stuff which is very painful to read about.
Like what?
Well, one of them is, I didn't even actually tell my father about this. And I'm not sure that this is true or not, but it's in the files. One morning I woke up and I told my grandmother that I dreamt that I shot my father. I was so angry with him. And there is a transcript, a beautiful transcript, in which she is trying to console me and to say, look, you're not evil. Don't feel guilty about this. Your father should have thought about the consequences. And now I look back on that file, and I don't actually remember the dream, but it is there as an archival document, a historical document that someone can say, well, look, it actually happened because it's written down by the secret police. I don't remember it, but I think about the implications. I wonder, you know, the effect that would have on him, you know, to say, look, I dreamed about this. Yeah. You see, it's all this exposure that goes on and on and on, fights that we had in a house, things that you say that you hope you'll never remember you said.
Is any of this helping you and your father kind of, have you been able to talk about this with him?
Well, this trip was extraordinary for the fact that we were able to talk about it.
And you say this trip. We should let our listeners know that last October your family went back to Romania. It was the first time in decades. Personally, for you, with the trip back to Romania, do you feel like you've completed the circuit so that you feel you're no longer defined by being an enemy or defined by what the Securitate kind of documented on what you said?
No, I think the trip opened more ground. We made peace with our situation in Romania and why we left and with the people there. But then at the same time, we realized that because of that situation, we have lost the country. We have been immigrants. We've been people without a home for 25 years.
Writer Carmen Bugan, she's the author of the memoir Burying the Typewriter, about her family's experience living under Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania. She's currently writing a memoir about returning to Romania and reading her family's Securitate files. Carmen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
News headlines are a minute away. This is The World from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, a Revolutionary War reenactor in Lexington, Massachusetts, who's a little different. He's Chinese-American.
When I walk down the street in my colonial clothes and I see an Asian family kind of looking at me, I'm kind of hoping somebody would say, wait a minute, you don't have to be, you know, a son of the American Revolution to join. You can be Chinese.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The agony continues in South Korea for the families of those missing after last week's ferry disaster. About 220 passengers, mostly high school students, are still classified as missing people. The ferry's captain, Lee Jong-suk, is in jail along with two of his officers. They're accused of abandoning their sinking ship without regard for the passengers' fate. South Korean President Park Geun-hye has called their actions tantamount to murder. Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul thinks the president may be trying to distance herself from the tragedy.
it's really strange that a president would, you know, declare her feelings about an ongoing investigation. It kind of raises the question, can this be a fair trial if Captain Lee Jun-suk and his crew do, you know, wind up in court? So I think a lot of people here, you know, while they do see that something went wrong on board the Sewol that day, they still hold their president accountable for what they consider to be, you know, foot dragging by the administration on rescuing all the victims on board.
What does the law in Korea actually state as far as a sea captain's duties to their ship?
South Korea is signatory to some international maritime standards. It does stipulate that a captain must ensure the safety of his passengers. And if it's found out that his actions or perhaps inactions lead to passengers' deaths, he could be punished. And it looks like at least 5 years in prison is what he could receive if found guilty.
Now, I don't want to come off as sounding cold here, but a ship going down and the way it's been described, listing and then sinking very fast, has anyone said, hey, it was everyone for themselves? I mean, we understand why the captain tried to get off.
I think in Korea, people expect the head of a company, the head of a country, the head of a ship to take full responsibility for their actions and the people underneath them. It's maybe some could say it's sort of a Confucian, a sort of a way of looking at responsibility. But the fact that Captain Lee was one of the first to be rescued when the ship was sinking. He and his crew got into one of the only lifeboats that was used as the boat was capsizing. Did not help his case.
I've got to say, Jason, we've been hearing so many different accounts as to when this captain left the boat, who he had given responsibilities to, whether they were qualified. What do we know for sure at this point about the crew on the boat and whether they, in fact, did everything in their capacity to save the passengers?
Marco, transcripts came out over the weekend of radio communication between the crew and controllers on land. It really painted a picture of confusion. It seemed very clear that the crew did not know when or how to evacuate passengers. They seemed to want the forces on land to dispatch rescue vessels as quick as possible, and they weren't going to give evacuation orders until that happened. Evidently, Captain Lee, he's told reporters that he was worried that if passengers jumped off the ship, that they'd be swept away in the current. So that's why he did not give an evacuation order. Transcripts also reveal that the intercom system on the boat was not completely functioning. So even if he did give an evacuation order, people wouldn't have heard it. But the investigation continues. We're still not even sure why this boat began to capsize.
This must be dominating all news coverage, just complete blanketing everything there right now. What is it like?
Marco, it's on everybody's minds here. I mean, the nation is in a state of mourning. Like over the weekend, sporting events were canceled. K-pop concerts were canceled. There were reports that even Samsung asked its employees to abstain from drinking and golfing over the weekend out of respect to the victims. Mm. You know, everyone in South Korea has ridden one of these ferries one time or another. I've been on a ferry operated by the Chunghae-jin Marine Company whose boat sank. They're very common to get from island to island here, and I don't think people have ever really considered their safety concerns until now.
Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul. Thanks for the update, Jason. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Marco. Thank you.
They're also blaming the government in Nepal, where at least 13 Sherpas died last Friday after an avalanche on Mount Everest. It was the worst reported disaster in Everest history. Today, people line the streets of Kathmandu to pay their last respects for some of the victims. No international climbers or foreign guides perished in that avalanche, just Sherpas, all locals, who were fixing ropes and carrying supplies up the mountain. Many team leaders and climbers at Everest Base Camp have since called off their expeditions. Others are still deciding whether to climb or not. And the Sherpas, they're considering a strike to demand insurance, benefits for families, and better regulations. A strike could suspend the entire climbing season. Freddie Wilkinson is a writer, a guide, and a climber. He's based in New Hampshire. Now, I gather you've been in touch with fellow climbers and guides at Everest Base Camp. What are you hearing? Are they all planning on suspending their expeditions?
No. things seem to be still very much up in the air. And what happened in the wake of this massive tragedy is that virtually the entire Sherpa workforce took a leave of absence to go home to their local villages and just kind of leave base camp and privately grieve. The bulk of those guys are not due back in base camp until Tuesday night or Wednesday. And so I think any judgment on what's going to happen is a little premature pending their return.
Now, one Sherpa family member said, I read this somewhere, right now I can't even think of going back to the mountain. It's a loss for the whole mountaineering community. If the Sherpas decide to boycott the rest of the season, though, won't that hurt their families and their livelihoods?
Potentially, there's been a tremendous amount of grief and sympathy from the Western climbers and the guide service organizers as well. So one would hope, you know, maybe they would still give them their full wages for the season, even if they don't continue.
Can you just lay out the dilemma both sides are facing right now following this avalanche and these deaths?
It's basically a supply and demand problem in a completely unregulated market. The Nepalese government in Kathmandu is very far removed from the practical problems the Sherpas face, and it's unlikely to see, you know, meaningful regulation coming from them. On the other hand, Sherpas very much want to work. They are in their culture, they respect being quiet and putting in an honest day's labor. And so I think they also are feeling strong feelings to want to continue and want to honor their professional commitments to, you know, Westerners who they have strong and real bonds with.
I guess it's unfair to paint all the climbers as rich foreigners, insensitive to the needs of the Sherpas, intent on getting to the top of Everest. What has been the reaction you're finding in the climbing community? Is this a moment of soul searching, do you think?
Absolutely. And I think the vast majority of Western clients and guides on the mountain are sincerely devastated by this. And it's been just as emotional and tragic experience for them. I think there's this additional step where all that sympathy and grief needs to be translated into a sense of responsibility that really is lasting and moving forward can be focused to help with real change.
Everest is the world's tallest mountain. I guess that's superlative enough to understand why so many people want to climb it. But what does the mountain mean for the Nepalese? Doesn't Everest have a nearly religious connotation?
It does. Over the years, as the main economic engine in the community, it's also a sacred thing for more practical reasons as well. Their livelihoods are tied to it and the image of it. And the Sherpas place a lot of stock in omens, and I wouldn't be surprised if many in the Sherpa community are looking at this incident as some kind of an act of revenge for people not paying the mountain more respect.
Writer, guide, and climber Freddie Wilkinson speaking with us from New Hampshire. Thank you, Freddie.
Thank you, Marco.
If you're a pregnant woman just about anywhere in the world, you'll face a critical question at a critical moment. When your labor pains begin, how will you get to the hospital in time to give birth? In rural India, there often is not an easy answer, at least there wasn't. As part of Ninth Month, our weekly look at pregnancy and childbirth across the globe, Ritu Chatterjee has this story.
In a remote village in the central Indian state of Madhya Pradesh, a modest concrete house stands on the side of a dirt path. Inside, Savitri Jatav tends to her family. My sons were all born here, she says. They were delivered in this very room. All three sons, she adds. Savitri is in her 40s. She says women here have always delivered at home. The nearest hospital is only about 6 miles away. But that's a long way off in these parts, where roads are bad and transportation options few. Dr. Govind Singh is a senior administrator at the big government hospital in the region, in the district of Shivpuri.
Maternal mortality in this region used to be about 400. That means for every 100,000 women who gave birth, 400 sacrificed their lives.
He says most women died of preventable causes, like excessive bleeding, infections, or obstructed labor.
The majority of women never made it to the hospital. Some villages are nearly 80 miles away from here, with no roads, no means of transportation.
But today, women have a far higher chance of surviving their pregnancy. That's because in 2007, the government of Madhya Pradesh, with the help of UNICEF, started a free ambulance service just for pregnant women. It's called Janani Express. Janani means mother. And the service transports pregnant women and new mothers from their villages to health facilities and back. The ambulances are located across the region. They're dispatched by a call center based here at the Shivpuri Hospital.
Hello, call center Shivpuri.
The center is just a small square room on the first floor of the hospital, staffed by one person at any given time. The dispatcher takes a call and then finds an ambulance closest to the caller through an online tracking system. He then contacts the driver of the vehicle. On this day, the driver is Suresh Karan. He's at a hospital in a little town called Pohari, and he's been told to go pick up a woman in labor. Karan doesn't waste time and is on his way. He's headed to a village called Nanora. That's where Savitri Jatav lives. She's the woman who delivered her three sons at home. And in fact, it's her daughter-in-law who's in labor, waiting for the ambulance. The ambulance is nothing but a small, beat-up-looking van with two long seats on either side. There's no medical equipment, just a first aid kit under one of the seats for deliveries that might happen in transit. When we reach Nanora, Karan parks the ambulance in the village square. A few minutes later, a group of women approaches the ambulance. Among them is 21-year-old Lali Jatav. She's a slight woman, hardly 5 feet tall. Her pregnant belly protrudes through the pleats of her sari. Her face is contorted in pain. Her steps slow and unsteady. Lali climbs into the back of the ambulance, lies down on one of the seats. She's joined by an aunt, her husband, and a village health worker to accompany her. The atmosphere inside the ambulance is tense. Lali's uncomfortable and sits up. Her aunt puts an arm around her, reminding her to breathe, and reassuring her that she's going to be fine. 20 minutes later, we reach the hospital and Lali is led to the delivery room. In a couple of hours, Lali gives birth to a healthy daughter. Mother and daughter will remain at the hospital for the next 2 days before returning home. Dr. Gagan Gupta is a health specialist with UNICEF India and helped launch Janani Express. He says the program started with a fleet of 35 ambulances in two districts.
And now we have this transport network across the entire state with nearly 1,000 ambulances providing 24/7 services.
He says last year alone, 1 million pregnant women used the ambulance service. And that's led to a dramatic rise in the number of institutional deliveries.
Previously, 3 out of 10 women were delivering in hospitals. Now nearly 9 out of 10 women are delivering in the hospitals. And there has been a sharp decline in the maternal mortality.
The success of Janani Express has led other states to start similar services, all funded by the Indian government. It's part of a broad effort to improve maternal health around the country. The ambulance service alone is no silver bullet, admits Gupta. But he says it's made a difference. And people in villages agree. Back in Nanora, Lali, the new mother, is home, lying on a cot holding a 2-day-old baby. Her mother-in-law runs around doing chores while stopping by Lali's bed now and then to beam at her new granddaughter. Times have changed for our daughters-in-law, Savitri says, thinking back on the time she gave birth to her sons at home. It's a lot more convenient now, she says. For the world, I'm Ritu Chatterjee, Nanora, India.
Ritu sent us a slideshow of Lali Jatav's Spartan ride to the hospital. You'll find it and other stories in our series about pregnancy and childbirth at PRI.org/ninth month. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When you think of graffiti, what comes to mind? Maybe some city kid snooping around subway stations, or maybe a subversive artist like Banksy working under cover of darkness. Well, if we're talking about the graffiti scene in Beijing, it's different.
It's really a middle class and up endeavor simply based on the money factor.
That's Lance Crayon. Yep, that's really his name. A Texas native who's been living and working in Beijing since 2009.
For a 19-year-old or even a 25-year-old to have something known as disposable income, that's a pretty new thing in China. And you've got to ask yourself, do I want to spend 500 kwai, which is roughly $82, on throwing up a piece that could, you know, easily be covered within a few days or at some point?
Crayon learned all about the street art scene there by interviewing local graffiti artists and filming them while they tag. And he's made a documentary called Spray Paint Beijing, Graffiti in the Capital of China. He says many street artists in Beijing work in broad daylight, and city officials are surprisingly okay with that. Which makes you wonder, how is that a country that so heavily censors its press and the internet allows graffiti on its streets?
As long as you stay away from anything political or anything too sensitive, from painting on temples or anything sacred and government buildings and things like that, you're not going to have a problem. And that's what they do. I mean, there's so much concrete in Beijing that when these guys paint on walls that aren't designated by the government, the citizens think they're making the city look prettier. And indeed they are.
Crayon says that foreign artists are gradually beginning to flock to the Chinese capital as word spreads about how lax the government is about graffiti. He says it's a stark contrast to how graffiti and taggers are viewed here in the U.S.
I'm a middle-class kid. I come from the suburbs. I didn't know what graffiti was growing up. And when I lived in New York and I lived in Los Angeles, I always liked it. But I didn't really know anything about it. More importantly, I wasn't given a chance to like it. Growing up, it's still the same now. Bombarded with, oh, it's against the law, it's illegal, it's ugly, it's dirty, it's disgusting, go down the list. Growing up, also, we're told that China is, again, you know, a totalitarian police state where nobody has any freedoms at all. But for graffiti to thrive the way it is, it's unbelievable. I'm still blown away by it.
Lance Crayon says Spray Paint Beijing has had some screenings in China and the UK, but he's still working on a distribution deal for the film here in the U.S. Finally today, this may be Marathon Monday here in Boston, but there's another tradition that's always celebrated around here on the third Monday in April. That's the annual reenactment of the Battle of Lexington. You know, the shot heard around the world. Lexington is kind of a traditional place, but as reporter and Lexington native Alina Simone tells us, it's not averse to change.
My first job ever, at age 14, was working as a waitress at a colonial-themed restaurant called The Pewter Pot. I served tourists Patriot fries and Franklin burgers, occasionally wearing a bonnet and some kind of scratchy frock. It sounds weird, but in my town, Lexington, Massachusetts, this was considered normal. Lexington's known as the birthplace of American liberty, and it's a tourist town, only instead of black sand beaches, we have, you know, the original chair George Washington sat on when he visited Monroe Tavern in 1789. The real draw, though, takes place every year on what's called Patriots Day, when thousands flood the Lexington Green to see the first battle of the Revolutionary War brought to life. In high school, a lot of my friends' dads took part in the reenactment. But even though my parents have lived in Lexington for over 35 years, we came there as immigrants, and I could never imagine my dad as a Lexington Minuteman. With their antique guns and tricorn hats, I just assumed the Minutemen were some kind of waspy blue blood old boys club. You know, carrying on the time-honored tradition of keeping outsiders out. That's why I was surprised when I learned about Henry.
I do know a lot of people, but I don't know everybody. But apparently everybody knows the Chinese reenactor in Lexington.
Henry Liu's parents were both born in China, but he was born in Massachusetts and has lived in Lexington almost his entire life. For the past 24 years, he's also been a musket-carrying member of the Lexington Minutemen.
I remember as a child going to the reenactments. And I have pictures of, you know, I've gone through photo albums and stuff, and I see pictures of myself dressed as a young Minuteman.
Despite being a massive history buff, Henry's decision to actually join the Minutemen had more to do with his wife. Her brother, her stepfather, and stepbrother were all members of the Minutemen.
The greeting when we got together for family things was always, "Oh, hi, Linda, how are you? And Henry, when are you joining?" And I'd always chuckle and say, "Oh, yeah, right, you really want a Chinese Minuteman in the ranks."
It turns out that, yeah, they did.
It is kind of funny because, you know, a lot of people ask me, you know, they thought you had to be a descendant or a son of the American Revolution to be a member, and it couldn't be farther from the truth.
Still, given Henry's initial reservations, it would have been easy for him to take a backstage role. Out of over 100 members, only 77 Minutemen get to field, and a lot of those spend the battle face down, eating grass. Instead, Henry decided to own it.
From 2004 through 2006, I portrayed Captain Parker, and I've met people who've been to that reenactment. And they would always look at me and go, "You were Captain Parker back then?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I mean, that's somebody who's standing in front of the company, telling the men what to do, you know, standing out in front, you're very visible." But, you know, I think when the event occurs, the clock turns back and people don't see Asians or blacks or anything. They see people in uniform and militia outfits, and they're there to reenact history.
The weird thing actually isn't that Lexington has a Chinese-American Minuteman, but that there aren't more of them. Since I graduated high school, the Asian-American population in Lexington has doubled to 20%.
Actually, when I walk down the street in my colonial clothes and I see an Asian family kind of looking at me, I'm kind of hoping somebody would say, "Wait a minute, you don't have to be, you know, a son of the American Revolution to join. You can be Chinese and be in this company," and sort of spark that conversation.
In the meantime, Henry's maintaining the tradition of recruiting from within. His son is already a member of the Fife and Drum Corps, with dreams of portraying William Diamond on the battlefield one day. I was right about one thing, though. The Minutemen are an old boys' club. Or at least a boys' club. You can be an Asian American Captain Parker, but you still have to be a U.S. citizen, and you have to be a guy. When I asked Henry if a woman had ever tried to join the Minutemen, though, he said no. Well, maybe, as this story proves, there's a first time for everything. As for personal history, when I visit my parents in Lexington, I still go to the Pewter Pot. Only it's a Thai restaurant now, called Lemongrass. And trust me, that's definitely a sign of progress. For the world, this is Alina Simone.
Patriots Day, we call it in Massachusetts, or, of course, Marathon Monday. Runners moved on today from those events last year, a dramatic moment that maybe many of us, with a knowing look or nod, will now be able to refer to as that day. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, the Annenberg Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Ford Foundation, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, and the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.